what it can contribute to the unfoldment of the consciousness of the person who is its temporary owner. As we become more discriminating and more selective, therefore, more interested in fulfilling the internal need of life rather than its material situations, we begin to develop more refined instincts in art and music and literature and all kinds of important things of this kind. In this way also, we begin to release the world and ourselves from very much of the competition and pressure of things. The person who is interested only in value, true value, is not a heavy competitor in the ordinary affairs of life. He is not going to war for his possessions and things of that nature. He is naturally a peace-loving, law-abiding, thoughtful citizen. Consequently, his karma moves in these directions. How is it then that in the idea of Buddhism or in Zen that we do not have the complete rejection of all things? In a sense, Buddha does give us this complete rejection, but his faith never accepted it. It never accepted the loss of beauty as a factor in religion. It never lost the fine painting or the magnificent carving. And gradually these were brought to adorn the very temples themselves. The same was true of Christian art. For while Christianity began as a very simple faith, there can be no doubt that men have heaped upon the shrines of their faiths their richest and noblest possessions, given generously and often with great contrition of spirit as an indication that inner consolation is more important than worldly goods. This type of thing we have always noted. Zen does not condemn beauty, but it does try to make it as simple as possible. Zen also tells us something else about things. Namely, that we become beggared to the skills and abilities of other people. Today, most of everything that we have, we buy in some degree of completeness. Little by little, we lose practically all creativity in ourselves. We are a great age of buyers, not an age of creators. And we do recognize and applaud those geniuses who produce some extraordinary or unusual work of art, and we probably will fairly generously support them. But the average person is not creative. 25, 35 years ago, it was customary for practically all families to at least have some music in their homes. Music probably mostly meant the piano, or singing, or a mandolin, or a guitar. But these younger people, and often with their parents and friends and neighbors, created music. Maybe not as good as the high fidelity of today, but at least creative. They were doing it themselves. And as a mystical experience in man, actually, to be able to pick out silver threads among the gold on the piano with one finger gives more creativity than a great symphony that you simply listen to and do nothing about yourself. There is no participation. And while appreciation is a great value, participation is of great necessity also. We have ceased to be creative. Zen would like to bring this back. It would like to do it through the encouragement of the whole concept of folk art and folk lore. It would like every person to be able to do something himself. Where the Zen people came from, Japan and China, they had one advantage that we do not have. Their families and their training had much to do with skill in writing. In Japan and China, writing is an art, and the written forms are considered as beautiful as pictorial design. When you write a beautiful poem, and you are a fine, have a fine example of writing, you are a good man with the brush. If you have this, you have produced a work of art in which your thoughts have been expressed through a very skillful use of your writing materials. Thus, most of your Orientals are halfway on the road to be painters by the time they are 10 years old. Because they have learned so marvelously to handle their brushes, they can turn almost immediately to various forms of artistic composition. And it is not at all uncommon in a Japanese family for the guests to produce or make art work as a symbol of their friendship among themselves. Here in this country, we have guest books. And when you have a party, your friends all sign the guest book. In Japan, you have little cards with gold edges that are supplied for this purpose. And on these cards, you write a poem, or you draw a picture, or both. Or you do something out of your own creativity, and you leave it with your host as a present. He is greatly honored. Everybody is profoundly pleased with the whole proceeding. And it is astonishing to see what you get. I know I have seen a number of collections of these things that have been in Japanese families. Here is a magnificent painting of storms, rocks, and sea. A beautiful work, as fine as anything you could find anywhere. It was not done by a professional artist. It was done by an honored guest who was a politician. Beautiful work of art. The next one was a wonderful painting of a small child, marvelously executed with the greatest detail. This one was done by a doctor who visited the family. So what do you have? You have engineers that are ivory carvers. You have doctors that are painters. You have politicians that are musicians. You have tradesmen who do most marvelous and delicate things. You will even find a magnificent poem, marvelously done, beautifully written, by the family masseur, or something of that nature. The gardener, who has already learned to work marvels with plants, is also able to make a beautiful drawing of a branch of cherry blossoms and a little bird. The man who you would call here the delivery man for some grocer store will leave you a beautiful little memento on the holiday season, a drawing which would be worthy of a great artist. He did it himself. Now this helps something. It means a tremendous amount in value. It means that these people have never lost the ability to create in themselves some expression to move consciousness out into action. When a great family in Japan ceases or passes out of existence and their possessions may be distributed in one way or another, collections of these gift cards or these equivalent to testimonials and mementos of various affairs, sometimes collections of great numbers of these drawings and poems and various little mementos have gone onto the market or gone on to auction. Some time ago, a collection of these pictures, done entirely by amateurs and cherished in a family for many years, several generations, was sold in Tokyo at a price that would be equivalent of about $75,000 American money, and was well worth it. And not one of them was by a professional. They were all by friends, by neighbors, by people who expressed and expressed beautifully. Now this is something that, how much is it and where can I buy it? Kills. This is something that causes us to go to the store and buy a present for our friend. So that when we visit him, we give it to him. But we have given something we have bought, not something we have created. he in turn is overjoyed because he knows that if we created anything, he'd have to throw it away. He knows that we have no skill anyway. He also would be embarrassed because it might mean that we would expect him to create something and he can't do it either. Or everybody gets together and gets a hobby shop and makes all kinds of bookends until every book in the neighborhood has two pair of ends. This is the imagination. It dies. We can, perhaps, with $15,000 to $20,000 worth of equipment, make a fairly decent card table. But with a 10-cent brush and a block of ink, these people do works of art. Great things. Simply because the consciousness is there. And the simplicity of method and the simplicity of media only more clearly reveals the creativity of the individual. So we have another element here of the problem of things. The importance of experiencing the creation of things. This creation of things is never to be regarded primarily as economic. None of these beautiful paintings were ever prepared to be sold to anybody. They were made simply from affection, regard, and esteem. They were spontaneous expressions of gratitude or appreciation, and they were not intended to be displayed to other people. It was just the person expressing himself because it gave him pleasure to do so. This type of thing is disappearing too much from our Western way of life. And in disappearing, we have lost most of our overtones. And when our overtones perish, our world perishes, as far as we are concerned. We cannot survive without them. So we must also, if we take things out of the world, we must give things to the world. Now these things are illusions, just like the things we take. But these illusions tell something that is not quite an illusion. They tell us something that brings us again into the Zen idea. Assuming that a Zen of high development was able to sit quietly on the side of a mountain and contemplate the entire unfoldment of the world, he would be in the presence of the grand illusion. He would be in the presence of things which seemingly exist. But he would be in the presence of endless change and eternal decay. And even while he blinked his eyes once, millions of living things perished. He would be, therefore, in the presence of a transitory existence. But if he was thus sitting quietly, contemplating these larger things, a pattern of symbolism would be created within his own consciousness. He would gradually learn from this illusion something of the nature of the reality behind it. He would use the grand illusion as a stepping stone to the unveiling of itself, as a means of gradually coming closer and closer to the mystery which is behind the illusion. Gradually, through his contemplation, this monk would become aware of the passing glory of worldly things. He would see value. He would see it rise and fall. He would see nations come and go. He would see inventions that make fortunes and then are discarded. He would see the heroes of today become the villains of tomorrow. The great actors who are forgotten. The great politicians who sink back into obscurity again. He would see all kinds of phenomena. And he would realize that all of this phenomena is suspended from what? And you come to the basis of the Zen concept of the Huayan doctrine, namely that all of these things are suspended from the void. The only thing that is real is this unknown, this thing which has neither beginning nor end, neither cause nor effect, but is the mysterious eternity into which all things are apparently retiring and declining again. Phenomena disintegrates into space, into eternity, into vacuum, into the void. into the depthness of things. And out of it gradually, the Zen monk would come to the conclusion or come to the realization that all this phenomena with its interplay and infinite relationship has one lesson to teach, one valid and authentic report to make, and that is the gradual revelation of the meaninglessness of itself. Therefore, all illusion is here for man to experience. For man's power to experience is limited to the experience of illusion. Man cannot experience reality. He cannot experience the void. He can experience anything else. But reality is beyond his comprehension, beyond his power to experience. Therefore, he must approach it by experiencing that which is not it. Now, it's the same way in a more humble manner with a problem of things. We discover what are the more valuable things, usually by discovering first those things which are not valuable. Why is this so? Simply because we can only determine value by experience. And we can only come to experience through the discovery of non-value. Judgment arises as the result of experience. It cannot anticipate it. A man cannot therefore be right before he has experienced. In this way, the correct judgment is always the last experience of the thing. Because upon this and upon this final experience alone, all previous experience converges. It is not possible, therefore, to be right in the first place and prove it later. You have to have the living proof growing and moving within yourself. Otherwise, you cannot know rightness. You cannot know which is value. So you have to outgrow the things which gradually prove that they do not help. A person placing great faith or trust in another individual is deceived. And in this experience, we are deceived many times, for every person has trusted the wrong individuals time and time again. But gradually, out of this disappointment, this disillusionment, in which we always blame the other person, but actually the blame lies in our own inability to sense value. But we pass through bitterness, we pass through antagonism, we turn against society, we hate everybody. We become afraid, almost, of our fellow man. We doubt his every thought and move, and we go on negatively in this way, continually hurt and continually hurting, and constantly afraid. Finally, this house of cards falls apart altogether. We ultimately realize that we cannot live with fear, that we cannot continue to hate without being sick and miserable. And no matter what anyone ever does to us, it cannot be as bad as what we are doing to ourselves by continuing this negative pattern. So sometime, somewhere, we wake up. And the moment we wake up into a value. We have outgrown something. We have come, therefore, to a new standard of what is important. And that which is important value is ultimately that which is of value. We do the same thing with our own personal appetites, our emotions, our ambitions. We pass through these circles and cycles in which we turn karma upon ourselves by the false efforts to press value where it does not exist. Ultimately, we relax. And the Zen monk takes the attitude that if we can relax completely, relax into the existent rather than into the existing, that suddenly we live in a universe in which we do not really need to own anything. We have things, we use them. We earn them if necessary. We are not going to become dependent upon other people. But ownership, possession, and the vast area of so-called status elements simply disappear. The individual becomes too concerned over the realities of life to permit himself to remain hypnotized by things of no importance. This is an experience. He is growing. So value has in material things the power to gradually disillusion us about these very things. And then we come to other material possessions which seemingly are more important. We come to the little Korean bowl, which is not in any way associated with the pressure and stress of our ordinary accumulation, but perhaps in the terms of material things could cost a pretty penny, particularly now. What is our attitude toward this? We can say to ourselves, we can sell it. Maybe we can have several hundred dollars or $1,000 or $2,000 and buy an automobile. But then the other individual who has it says to himself, where is my value? Is my value in this automobile or is my value in this bowl? What is important to me as consciousness? What is the value of this thing in comparison to some other thing? And he may say, this thing gives me peace of mind. This gives me relaxation. I feel better. I'm happier. I feel a warm, intimate kindliness come over me when I look at this little bowl. Put me behind the wheel in an automobile and I may become a relentless destroyer of men. I will work out all kinds of complexes and frustrations on society. Or perhaps I will make a lot of trips to places where I had no real intention of going. And as the Chinese observed, when they gave him an ox cart, he was traveling so fast he no longer could see anything anyway. There is no way of traversing, as the Taoist monk says, the path of life that is as dramatic as to go on foot. Because when you go on foot, you go slowly. Every beautiful scene, as you turn a little corner, you can pause and consider. You live in a world that is larger because you are traveling more slowly. After a while, you travel very fast. The world feels very small, appears to get smaller every day, and one morning you wake up with the delusion that you can conquer it. Men who walk seldom attempt that, because they see the infinite diversity of life as they proceed. So again, what are the important things? One great Oriental artist said the most important thing he had ever seen was a little flower growing out from under the edge of a stone. In that moment he received a Zen enlightenment. The sensitivity of this situation suddenly produced the strange result that is called Satori. It was a sudden sensing of kinship with life. And there is nothing in the world in the form of pots and pans and all kinds of gadgets that could possibly bestow this. Because here was something that had its primary ingredient, namely that it was natural, that it was eternal, that no one had to own it, that no one cared. But in this thing was something no one could own, something utterly beyond all ordinary value. And there's another thing that's interesting about this type of thought. What would have happened if two men, one Asiatic and the other a Westerner, had both seen that little flower growing under the edge of the rock? Now, what would have happened? Supposing they were both good men. The Easterner simply stood very quietly and looked at it and allowed the meaning of it to possess him. The Westerner also looked at it. He was profoundly moved. He was deeply touched. It was such a precious thing that he had to pick it and put it between two sheets of paper and save it forever. So out of sheer affection, he killed it on the spot, which is our typical way of doing things. He couldn't leave it alone. The Eastern man did not need to pick it, because it was always in his heart from that moment on. He could recall it at any instant. And maybe 20 years later, with a brush on a piece of silk, he could have drawn it again, with all its perfection, for he would have accepted it into himself and then allowed it to move out of himself again onto a piece of silk. It would have been somewhat strangely changed, more symbolical, perhaps even simplified from the little mystery of itself. But to the Easterner, life was there, not to destroy, but to admire. Not to take, but to leave. Not to interfere with, but to bless. Whereas in the West, what we want, we must take. What we desire, we must have. And we sort of have a feeling that all things exist in order that we can pick them. We mean well, but we have trouble with this flower in the crated wall. We have trouble with it. We have the tremendous desire to possess it. This is the essential difference between the person who can enjoy the thing, who lives in a world of things that are all his because he has never claimed any of them. An individual who, because he has never claimed them, can never lose them. And they all fit together to form the Satori experience. They give to this individual something of the mystery and the grandeur of space itself. So when we go into value in terms of things, everything that is alive has its own value. It is itself. Everything that is not alive, in the sense of still a growing organism, things like little pots and vessels and fabrics and things like that, in which there is no longer the inherent vitality of continuous growth. Where this is absent, then a new value has come in, a kind of life which is now a combination of the materials and the genius which fashioned them into something. So that in each of his little vessels, the soul of the potter still lives. In each of his fabrics, the master weaver has a certain continuance. And there is a different kind of aliveness. The aliveness of creativity. The aliveness of noble example. One of the things that we can gain from great art are the wonderful crafts of the world. Is a revival, a refreshment of our faith in men. Today it looks so easy to say that there are not many good people left in this world. And we look back over history and we read of war and plague and pestilence. We say there probably never were many good people in this world. This world has been a pretty selfish place. And then we find the little bowl. We do not know who made it, but the person who made that had to have been a great person, had to have been a beautiful person, had to have had in themselves this tremendous power of understanding. Though it may not have been a cultured understanding. It may not have been an understanding that resulted from many years' study of potteries and ceramics. It wasn't. It was simply the understanding of the individual who needed a bowl for his tea. He had no thought of being an artist whatsoever. But he had to live with his bowl. He could only make it the way he felt it. It took him probably all of 2-3 minutes to spin it out on a wheel. But he had to do it himself. And it had to be something that he could say, I will drink my tea from this because I like it. So in a strange way, in this simple way, this craftsman, this simple farmer perhaps, has created or revealed the great artistry of the human soul. He has caused to come out of himself something of exquisite beauty, something that the ages will admire. Now all over the world, things of this kind have been done. They've come from simple people. They've come from the rich and the poor. They've come from every level of society. And everywhere they tell that inside of man there is a yearning for that which is good. A determination to express some inner conviction. There is an honor, an honesty, and an integrity tremendously found in folk art. whether it be African or Asian or American Indian or wherever it comes from. It is simply honest love of good things. Too poor to buy them, but not too poor to make them. These people probably consciously would love to have bought a bowl and paid a great deal for it and have been able to drink their tea out of a cup that was as fine as that of some mandarin. But they couldn't. Because they couldn't, they did not buy. They became great by creating. And there is no greatness in buying. There may be selectivity, but there is not the greatness of creation. So in these things, we get a realization that inside of man, there is a universal value. It is his own value. We don't say that this universal value comes from one source and that sometime all bowls will look alike, that there will someday be a perfect bowl. Actually, that someday is this moment. This moment there is a perfect bowl. These great things have already achieved perfection in an instant. And having achieved perfection, they have fulfilled themselves. And while they are great and wonderful things, and we admire them, the great person is not even going to worry about them, other than to be kind and guard them gently. Because he knows that someday that bowl will be broken. It may take 100 years, it may take 1,000 years, but ultimately all of these beautiful things will disappear. Others may take their place, or perhaps we will lose this sense of value entirely and drift into a lower level of function, which I hope does not occur. But actually, the value of these things is first in our appreciation. But actually, more than that, the great value was in the revelation of the soul of the Creator. Each human being performing his own satori, performing his own revelation of the great meditation of life. It is only when we somewhat simplify that this is possible. And I think that we would have much more of this creativity if we did not so falsely associate value with things that are expensive and that we buy. We have become a world of buyers instead of a world of people who are expressing creativity. And in the West, of course, even our artists, with a very few exceptions, have been unappreciated. It has taken centuries to discover them, simply because we are too busy in this endless pursuit of the accumulation of things. And our present state is a monument to this, the natural karma of it. And unless we learn this lesson and break through the pattern, we will go on creating this situation for centuries yet to come. So we can now summarize a little bit our problem of things, and things as term of value. Things are valuable, perhaps, as mirrors, which we can hold before our own faces. Whatever we like, whatever we say we want so badly that we have to go out and buy it, perhaps as a luxury that we just feel we need, what does it mean? Are we buying something that is really fine? Are we telling a story about the desire to release soul power, or are we merely telling of an ambition to accumulate? There's a great deal of difference between a collector and an accumulator in art. An accumulator may have a wealth of possessions and have very little appreciation. An accumulator may hire agents to do most of his buying for him. An accumulator may elect a custodian or a curator of his collection, who will make all of the necessary markings and records and will do all the research on these things, with the result that the custodian becomes a very well-informed man and probably develops a great deal of culture, whereas the owner has nothing, because no man can chew another man's food for him. So the actual problem of what you choose, what you sacrifice, how you decide these things should give you a little insight into your own place in the evolution of your own consciousness. If you find an instinct, a definite instinct towards status, if it becomes subtly, terribly important, you have just a little more of the same than your neighbor. If there is a sudden feeling that, after all, you have to keep up with the mode, whatever it may be, that you just simply can't afford to live in a house that is different from the prevailing style, then you are simply telling yourself and everyone else that you do not have the courage or the insight to be moved or to be ruled from within yourself. If, however, you have the courage to be moved and self-ruled, this presents another slight difficulty. Supposing you decide to be original about all these things, you're going to live your way. The result must not be merely eccentricity. That does no good. I know people who have done it their way, and it is an abomination to themselves and everyone else. It's not just enough to be emancipated or liberated, or to say, I don't care what other people think, I'll do it my way. You do that naturally. But when you have the result, what have you got? And if the result is no good, it is no better because it is your result than it would be if it was anyone else's. So if in the effort to be original, you find that you only achieve a monumental bad taste, then you have to go to work on that. You have to realize that to be original, you must be creative. You have to have the internal insight. So that originality is always within law. That it is always the application of proper principles. You can be original in color just as much as you want to, but you can never break the harmonic patterns of color without creating discord. You can compose anything you want to on the piano, but you must keep the rules of harmonics and melody or you're in trouble. So when you decide that you are not going to be one of the herd and are going to do your own deciding and determine your own values, then you have to be sure that you can do so. That this liberty is not merely license. To attain this end, of course, we have the problem of the gradual refinement and development of taste factors. And the person who tries to be eccentric too soon is only a rebel. He is not outgrowing the situation which he's trying to leave behind. He is in defiance. He is not in recognition of value. So you have to have the power and the skill to do these things better. And this means that you have to gradually develop a better level or standard of value. The things that you choose must be chosen because of their own betterness. I've seen a number of examples of this type of thing working, in particularly the western part of our own country. There are some very beautiful homes in this area. When I mean this area, I mean Southern California. Many of these homes, I would say the majority of them, are not expensive homes. There are many very expensive homes, but they are not usually the best ones. Many of them represent no more in an investment than the average person has put in a tract house. But they have indicated that the individual himself, the family, had discovered something of Satori. There was something good about these houses. There was something that showed a great simplicity, a wonderful natural dignity. And it was economical also, because it is much easier not to have bad things than it is sometimes to afford good ones. Therefore, quietude, simplicity, and directness mark a number of fine homes. And they also show the dawning appreciation of good art, good value, perhaps only in a simple object, but no longer the great cluttering, no longer the mass of things. Also, I remember visiting a very interesting apartment in New York City many years ago. It was one of these old brown stone fronts. And from the outside, it looked as though it belonged to a decadent period of the gay 90s in New York life. But when you went inside, you moved from this very obvious exterior into an inner world that told the story of the owner completely. A world of beauty, of great taste, a world of wonderful things accumulated over a lifetime, but with great discrimination. And this same person not only had these wonderful things, but was completely free of the sense of ownership. They were not important or beautiful or valuable because they were his. He simply lived among them with the full experience of the fact that one of these days they would pass to someone else. He had no definite desire to hold on to them. But he said, as they move by as beautiful pictures, I can look at each one and be refreshed by it. And this type of thing does come into the lives of people. Now, I've noticed also that students of religion and philosophy and metaphysical and mystical matters have neglected this phase of their lives for the most part. They have sort of felt that life was a problem of study, that they had to meditate their way to nirvana as quickly as possible, or that they had to in some way leave all this world behind long before they had outgrown it. Now, this is a mistake. You don't leave anything behind wistfully, sorrowfully, longingly. Actually, we move through philosophy through a continuing experience of values. Our philosophers in education and our scientists would be much better people if they loved art, if they loved the gentle things of life more sincerely, if they developed great taste in these things, a great discrimination, that you could see shining through their lives these few fine, simple evidences that their inner consciousness was working. If this could happen, we would have a much better civilization than we know now. And in the processes of meditation and mystical growth, if people were able to prove their growth by their discrimination, if they could prove that they're better people simply because everything they do is done with a better understanding of value, we would find that the very demonstration of value would in turn move in upon these people and help them to grow more rapidly. All things being equal, if you are a custodian of your environment. You are a custodian of everything that you have. It is either helping you or hurting you. You're either using it or abusing it. And through gradually clarifying the life around us, we reveal the integration of the life within us. This is all very important. It's something that's hard to talk about. But it's something that, once it is experienced, becomes tremendously meaningful. Esotericists in general, advanced psychological students, students of comparative religion and the great philosophies of the world, should all of them be thoroughly aware of the great values of art, music, and literature. They should have these values so clear that the discipline of simplicity is moving in upon their conduct. All cluttering, all confusion, all conflict over things should be gradually but inevitably fading out. And in its place should be clear, simple decisions. The recognition of value, the importance of certain things, the perfect willingness to sacrifice other things for those which are most needed at the moment as expressions of consciousness. So that someday the individual may say to himself, I'm not going to buy that new car this year, I'm going to buy that little Korean bowl. I will keep on driving the old car, but I will be very happy because I'm living with beauty. This decision comes as a little wrench at a certain time. But when it is right, you just can't buy the car. You just have to buy the bowl. That's all there is to it. There's no longer any conflict. But this tells something about you when it happens. It tells something about the fact that your own inner life is moving out and eternal value is coming to be more important. Now, it is true that the little bowl has not an eternal value. It is true that, as we say, it will be broken and discarded sometime. But the little bowl has peculiarly captured an eternal rhythm. For some reason, which we will never perhaps be able to fully define, the man who made it happened, because of his own consciousness, to make it right. He did something by means of which hundreds of other persons who have seen and owned this bowl since then have all known that it was great. They have sensed it because they have lived with it. It has moved them. There's something about this little bowl that reaches into the life of us and rejoices the soul. So when the time comes, we probably will find more rejoicing in this than we will in one of the products of the Detroit tin factories. And we will say to ourselves, I would rather walk and live with that bowl. Now, it's very probably we won't have to walk, but we'll have to sacrifice something. But it is not sacrifice anymore, because we are using what we have to fulfill the need of our own consciousness. And when we see something that makes us feel a little more of reality, which makes us more gracious, more understanding, more tolerant and more patient of all other things, when something comes that is medicine to consciousness, makes us a little happier, a little wiser, a little better, then instinctively that is the thing that we most need. That is the thing that is valuable. And for that, we are willing to pay the price. But we are not willing to pay the price merely to maintain some kind of a competitive relationship with other people. So out of all of this comes a philosophy of art and a philosophy of value that I think has meaning. And perhaps if you are able to sort of experience between the lines, you will see what I am trying to say. It is very abstract. But it is like Zen, it's something you can't put into words. But once you've experienced it, it is always yours. And once you know what it means, you can never lose that knowledge. And once you build your values upon that, you will always know what is important, what is valuable. And you will always know what price a thing is worth. Whether it is worth the sacrifice, whether it is worth the love, or whether it is not. And little by little, you will become more discriminating, and your friends and neighbors and everyone else will realize that an important change is occurring in you, a change that not only makes you like little bowls, but a change which makes you closer to truth, closer to the universe, closer to consciousness, nearer to the mysterious power of God, which is forever creating little bowls and embodying in them the great majesty of universal law. All this sort of moves through us. And here is the story of the value of things and why things can be helpful even though they are perishable and belong to the world of values that must sometime fade away. Well, I guess our time is up, so thank you very much for this attention while we meandered through this rather interesting but perhaps somewhat abstract subject. Thank you very much.